If you'll gather round me, children, a story I will tell about Purdy Boy Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee, a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon, as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger, and his wife she overheard. Purdy Boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer, the same old story told. How the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say. Well, you say that I'm an outlaw. You say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Yes, as through this world I've wandered, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you will never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Yeah, that's why there's more honest men in prison than in the White House, percentage-wise, per capita. Absolutely. Whoa, my microphone's turned backwards.
But I guess you heard it anyhow. How about that? Yeah, Purdy Boy Floyd and those guys back then in the Depression. And the only thing that got us out of Depression was Roosevelt's war, getting us into war in Europe and the South Pacific. Yes, through the back door they did. They claim, oh, we were attacked, we were attacked. Well, you need to read history a little closer to what the U.S., France, and England were doing to the Japanese before the war, and how they were all set to invade Japan long before Pearl Harbor, because the Air Force had big bombers already stationed in China ready to go. But you got to read your history, boys and girls, if you know what the hell's going on. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana on a warm but overcast day. Yeah. It is the 3rd of July, 2015. I probably won't do a show tomorrow because I'll be in gnashing my teeth and trying not to hear all the bullshit fireworks and stuff. And really, it should be a day of feeling bad for all the men who died literally for nothing in this country. But they're going to try to make it a big holiday. And all the guys who died in the Civil War and the First World War and the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam, they died for a wonderful cause. Yeah, bullshit. they died trying to save their own lives is how they died. That's the way it is on the battlefield. One of the people that are not closely identified with us sent me an email because I'm always telling them the truth about the way things are. They're all set to back Trump, and like I said, never back a billionaire. And they were telling how wonderful Reagan was, and I told them all about Reagan, what a crook he was and what a war criminal he was. They've made him, you know, the worst war criminals they make into the big heroes, name airports and highways and everything after him. Now, I knew Ronnie Reagan when he was first thinking of running for governor, and I worked in his office down in Manhattan Beach, California. I learned all about Ronald Reagan and that phony southern strategy the Republicans came up with, not because they liked the white race, but because they wanted to get the white race away from the Democrat Party. Anyhow, this guy sent me this note and said I was a pessimist. And I said, I'm a realist, not a pessimist. You know, Red Skelton, the comedian, used to say, quote, "I calls them the way I sees them," unquote. I'm optimistic that nature will take its course, no matter how man tries to fuck it up. That's my position. Actually, when you look at it from nature's point of view, all of this crap going on is pretty funny, really. You can get a lot of laughs out of the news. Not like the conservative reactionaries that cry and moan. Yeah. Believe me, nature will take care of it. Well, let's see what we're going to do today. Let's see. I'm looking at this vast amount of books on the shelf, and shall I go back into the terrible times in the past as it applied to the working people and poor people? Or should I remind you that the whole Revolutionary War was somewhat of a scam? I think you need to know that. I've read it to you before, but I think you need to know that because tomorrow we're going to celebrate something that should not necessarily have been celebrated at all. Oh, my God, I'm going to get flack from that. Well, I guess that plans out about the Revolutionary War. I may find it between now and tomorrow. If I do, I'll read it tomorrow, but if I do anything. But I made the dastardly mistake of moving my library, or at least half of my library, several months ago, but it was in a narrow area where I can only step back about 2 feet from the library, and it's very difficult to find a book. So I'm back there on my hands and knees, you know, almost looking for a book, and so I'm going to have to just bite the bullet and put my books and shelves back in the middle of my operating room where I can get at them. Because if I can stand back and look at a library, I can usually spot a book pretty easily. But the way it is now, I'm screwed. Okay, we're going to read about the terrible time. We're going to continue with our exposure that the system doesn't like you to pay attention to, of the terrible times. The good old days, they weren't. Okay, let's see what we can find. Well, I don't think I started this on rural life yesterday, so if I did, pardon me, but we're going to go with it. It is difficult to think of country life without illusion. We're always tempted to invest it with virtues that appear to have been corrupted in urban culture. And rural folklore, shamelessly exploited, intensifies images of idyllic simplicity and bedrock values. Country living presents visions of nostalgia to soothe the city nerves, but these visions are grossly inaccurate, especially when applied to the good old days. Country life in the post-Civil War era was an unremitting hardship. The farmer and his family toiled 14 hours a day merely to sustain themselves, primarily on a landscape that lacked the picturesque inspiration of Currier and Ives' prints, which reminds me that Civil War was so ridiculously unneeded, to where in some ways maybe it would be best for the South to have won and separated, and then shipped all the Negroes back to Africa or someplace else but here, and then broke up the land, big landowners situation in the South, and created an agricultural, a really good, healthy agricultural system, which there would have been plenty of Irish, German, and all those kind of immigrants more than willing to move south, and also they could have started industry in the South. Anyhow, I was thinking about that the other day. But otherwise, it would not have been necessarily good for the South to win. They would be proving a point that it was their right to secede. There's no doubt about that. Too bad it was on the issue of slavery. Nor did their endless drudgery reward the farmers with prosperity during the economic distress of 1870 to 1900. Few small and middle-sized farms produced anything beyond bare subsistence, and many were foreclosed. In place of the neat rose garden, an expanse of muck and manure surrounded the farmhouse, sucking at the boots and exuding a pestilently stench that attracted swarms of flies, ticks, worms, to amplify the miseries of man and beast. The elemental task of survival precluded any concern for hygiene or sanitary installations, and the punitive winter brought with its isolation and terrible loneliness. A recurring image of the late 19th century farm life is a charming sun-filled kitchen where an Aunt Polly, two cries of land sakes, empties second helpings of steaming victuals into plates that reflect calico, freckles, and perfect adjustment, with the possible exception of the gentry. History offers a different picture. The country kitchen, as the heart of the farmhouse and its only heated area, served equally as a dining room, living room, and washroom. It was primitive and usually crowded beyond the point of intimacy. Cooking, the kitchen's major activity, was done in an open hearth fireplace with crooks and arms, or, more likely, on an iron stove. The early stove was an appliance of marked obduracy, a penal rock pile on which many a good country wife prematurely spent her beauty and strength. Kept burning the year round, it made one demand, dry wood, and delivered one temperature, very hot. Today's petulant complaint, quote, slaving over a hot stove, unquote, applies literally to the farmer's wife of the Victorian age, who required a placid temperament to endure the rigors of running a country house. Laundry was the most physically punishing labor on the farm wife's routine. She tackled it once a week, normally in the yard, first lugging huge kettles of hot water from the kitchen or else building a fire outdoors for the same purpose. She had no machinery or miracle detergents at the time, only muscle power. Now, I remember as a kid, still in the late 40s, early 50s, being put on the washing machine by my mother, where I had to turn the crank to run the clothes through the wringer. And we had to heat the tubs of water on the stove, fill up the tubs, have a tub on each side of this old washing machine, and Tommy's job was to turn the crank. That's what you've heard said before, don't get your tit caught in the wringer. Well, it's pretty easy to get your fingers caught in the wringer, that was for sure. Only muscle power, a hollowed-out log and doubled as sink and scrubbing board, and chunks of homemade soap. Yeah, we used to take Fell's Naphtha bar soap and cut it up in little pieces and then run water through it. We did that in the Army, too, in the kitchen, in KP duty. The mountain of farm filthy wash had to be reduced piece by piece, which meant hours of beating, rinsing, and wringing before it fluttered triumphantly on the line. Of course, you know, if it was wintertime, your laundry would freeze like a board, and you'd have to go out and lift it all into a, like cordwood, take it in the house and thaw it out. The young country wife required stamina and fortitude equal to perhaps even greater than her husband's, and she soon acquired the calloused hands, stooped back, and careworn features that marked her station. This book's got a lot of pictures in it, too, that really take you back. Fresh well water? The old wooden bucket delusion. The stone well and the wooden bucket are romantic symbols of a country life in the 90s, evoke nostalgia for the purity of spring water and derisive snorts at the chemical manipulation of the modern tap water. Well, hell, I remember the first house my parents owned, which they bought a corn storage building, moved it across the street, put a basement under it, and put wallboards on it and carpet in it and called it a house. And we had a pump on the back porch. You had to go outside the house to get your water. Yeah, and that was in the early 50s. However, our confidence in nature's ability to purify should be balanced by an appreciation of man's ability to pollute. The well water was indeed clean in the beginning, but the farmer inadvertently contaminated it. For practical purposes, the well was dug close to the farmhouse, which itself was close to the barnyard, stable, pigsty, co-op, and cesspool, with not even a pretense of drainage. The well was thus exposed to all sorts of noxious matter seeping through the ground, slush from the kitchen, festering matter from privies, and seepage from animal waste posed a growing danger to the water supply and filled the air with vile odor. A number of health experts warned that much of the sickness and unexplained misery of the country dweller could be traced to polluted wells, but they were ignored, even by some physicians. Quote, "I knew a doctor," said R.L. Dufus, "who had a cow barn, a privy, and a well all within 100 feet of his kitchen." In prairie regions, parts of New England where well drilling was often unsuccessful, rainwater was collected in garrets, barrels, and underground cisterns. Yeah, I remember those big barrels. In fact, that's a good thing to do today, is put the big barrels under your downspout and save that water. While not exposed to seepage contamination, it developed its own peculiar infestation from dust and flies. In the summer, the country dweller 100 years ago, swatted insects was an impractical solution to the summer invasion of flies, mosquitoes, and their kin that turned the farmhouse into a buzzing, biting bedlam. In fact, there was no solution. They swarmed through the open windows of the farmhouse, alighting on food and the family, massing about the stove and ceiling, blackening fruit, wallowing in milk crocks, and dying in the soup. During meals, boys were assigned leafy branches, fly shewers, to help decrease other diners' suffering. Night brought no relief as the detestable insects assembled in the bedrooms to plague the defenseless sleepers. You know, you wonder that this may have led to the strong physical genetic makeup of the white race. Is if you live through all of this crap and bred into another generation, you were one hell of a guy or a woman. So this may have in some ways contributed to the strength of the race. Russell Lyons said of a window screening introduced in the 1880s, that it was the most humane contribution the 19th century made to the preservation of sanity and good temper. Just screens for over your windows. Before technology rescued them, it appears that the country people were faced in every crisis with a Hobson's choice. In summer, if they opened their windows to avoid suffocation, they were eaten alive by insects. And in winter, if they closed the windows to avoid freezing, they choked on smoky air. The source of this winter indoor pollution was the iron stove, an inefficient little monster that glowed red hot, sucking all virility from the air and replacing it with smoke. Well, we had a coal-burning stove in the middle of our living room, but we had a chimney which vented most of the fumes. But we used to heat hot water on it and everything else. The preservation of heat being a higher priority in the house than proper ventilation, the farm family inhaled a harmful gas instead of crisp country air that surrounded them. On the prairie, the scarcity of fuel made freezing in the rickety shacks and huts an ever-present danger. The floor was the frozen earth itself, and the only warm spot was the stove. During the blizzard, it was not uncommon for the homesteader to bring the farm animals into his hut, and at times it became necessary to break up the furniture to feed the stove. Some of you may have heard the saying, hotter than a depot stove. Well, in every town, small town especially, where they had a train depot, they had a big cast iron stove in the middle of the station, and they kept that thing almost red hot all the time, and people from all over the village would come down to the train station to get warm. As Hamlin Garland summed it up, winter? No man knows what winter is until he has lived through a pine board shanty on a Dakota plain with only buffalo bone for fuel. In addition to the rural life's drudgery, there was a social menace, one which challenges a familiar assumption that the countryside was at least free of crime. The vagrant population posed a constant threat, bands of drifters and individual bums who lived by theft and begging. The nuisance showed no decrease towards the end of the century when an official census put the tramp population at 50,000. An army larger than Wellington's was at Waterloo. While most of the tramps were not dangerous criminals, their outlandish appearance and mean disposition aroused fear in the farming communities they passed through. They formed a subculture that made people apprehensive, not for their scrounging or thefts of vegetables and underwear from the clothesline, but for the excesses they looked capable of. And this apprehension was not entirely groundless. That reminds me of how people react to Negroes going through their neighborhood. A lot of times it was more their appearance, more their appearance than what they were doing. From all over the East came reports of thefts, incendiary fires, rapes, and even murders committed by vagrants. In some New England towns during 1877, people were forced to abandon their homes. In our fascination with the sensational violence of the Old West, we tend to regard the East of a century ago, especially rural East, as crime-free, but that simply was not the case. Hold it. Farm children, they led a life of mind-dulling blandness. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy is an old saying that was curiously appropriate to farm children of both frontier and rural East. From childhood, the farmer's sons and daughters were routinely assigned multiple chores that filled their non-school hours and limited their intellectual growth. Maybe that's what happened to me. I had a lot of chores. Luckily, I got into ham radio. That sort of got me out of that. To envision the farm youngster's life in the Victorian period as one filled with carefree adventures is therefore a misconception. Apart from seasonal high points like the 4th of July or a little sleighing in the winter, their lives were modeled after their parents' lives, drudgery without end, while girls toiled along with their mothers, whose hardships were compared with those of oxen. Boys toiled along with their fathers and trudged at as early as an age of 10 years old behind their own plow team. In general, the farmer's attitude to formal education was one of grudging concession, for they regarded the demands of school as depriving them of a free workforce. You see that among the Mexicans a lot down in Southern California and so forth. and the schools closed in the summer months not for vacation, but to enable young laborers to return full-time to the land. Quote, there just wasn't a minute to spare, unquote, recalls Millard F. Kennedy about his boyhood in Indiana. Quote, a 9 or 10 years of age, I had so many chores to do that it seemed to my infantile mind like I practically ran the farm, unquote. There was little about the early farm to inspire or satisfy a young mind. Lacking mechanical aids, the farm was crude, untidy places where broken carts and equipment languished in the fields, where waste heaps filled the yard, and pigs had free range. Beyond learning to shovel dirt and shoe a horse, there was nothing to excite youthful curiosity. There was no chance to master the mechanical arts that a young man now needs to rise in life and give scope to his ambitions. The farm children were notoriously immature, not as the result of an evil design, but because the rigors of family survival made adult demands on their bodies and left their minds undeveloped. And to a lot of adults, that's the way they liked it. In the 1880s, before corporate farmers began erasing the horizon with money crops, close to 40% of the farmers were tenants, owning neither a house nor the land. The shabbiness of the property, and I ran into this tenant farming in the South when my parents and I traveled to Florida a couple of times, and we'd stop along the way and talk to people, and some of them were still drinking water out of an open well. I remember one black old lady I was talking to, and she took me over and showed me the well. They were still putting the bucket down the well. And those tenant farmers, if they got in debt to the landowner and they tried to take off, well, the sheriff would go after them just like the slave masters had these guys that they appointed to go out bringing the blacks back. Well, they did the same thing to tenant farmers. A lot of white people don't want to talk about that. The shabbiness of the property reflected the tenant farmers' debts, despair, and lack of personal pride. Industrialization, which for the working class held at least the promise of prosperity, was a major cause of the decline of the family farm. Needing machinery to survive, farmers increased their debts to reduce pressure, and foreclosures drove these bewildered yet stoic people westward by the thousands. New England especially was stripped of its best men who headed out apparently unaware of where they were going. Foreclosures were also approaching flood-tide proportions. Out of the frying pan into the fire, huh? The railroad monopolies, faithful to their calling, added to the trouble. Holding sway over the land, they seduce arriving farmers with lots of easy terms, only to hold them as ransom by charging outrageous freight rates on the produce for market. The populist movement started in 1880 with the Kansas Revolt. It was spawned by the farmers' anger at the falling prices and the widespread foreclosures. But it was a vain fight. They were absorbed in the end by what they feared most, the understood least, the produce monopolies, agribusiness in its infancy. Again, the ruling class, always been there, always manipulating. Always greedy. Nothing changes. There was little rejoicing for Western farmers who managed to remain independent as they faced periodic attempts by another and more violent force to repossess their property. Nature, particularly hostile on the frontier, put their durability to the test and often won. On the plains of Nebraska, fierce winds filled the air with dust that penetrated houses, blew into the eyes, nostrils, hair, and made walking a supreme effort, let alone doing chores. At times, farmers were confronted with the heartbreaking task of re-sowing after acres of young plants had been uprooted in the fury of the wind. People caught in the Midwestern storms were transfixed by its fearful majesty. One observer recalled an electrical squall that caused bolts of fire to jump from the horns of oxen. Then, too, there were insect plagues which ravaged the land. Such disasters are unlikely today because of crop dusting and pesticides. Yeah, but as the crops become and the insects become resistant to all their crappy insecticide, it's going to start all over again, probably. Grasshoppers were a constant threat, as were the Rocky Mountain locusts, which in 1867 obliterated in a single day the whole of Dakota's harvest. A few years later, they returned to strip the bark off trees, stopping trains cold as the oil from their crushed bodies made the locomotive's wheels spin. As if summoned by biblical prophecy, they would darken the western sky with humming clouds, at times 150 miles wide by 100 miles deep. The same wilderness that today is threatened by man threatened him 100 years ago. Oh, yeah. More fun and games. One aspect of the frontier has been dodged persistently to satisfy the vagaries of folk drama, the isolation and loneliness of families who lived there. There was no place lonelier than the frontier. The legal proviso that a homesteader stay on his claim often extended for miles around, practically excluding human contacts. There was nowhere to go, no one to see, no casual visitors, no passersby. The prairie itself, a bleak, flat expanse unrelieved by so much as a single tree, emphasized the settler's sense of physical separation from the human community. Winter intensified their isolation, shutting them indoors for long periods and leaving them without even the meager comfort that the sight of another living creature might bring. Quote, "There is no bird life after the geese have passed on their way south. The silence of death rests on the landscape, save where it is swept by cruel winds and that drive through the cottages, unguarded apertures, the dry, powdery smoke, snow. The separation from neighbors and relatives was especially distressing. Adding to the bleakness was the absence of an occasional social event that would involve some of the happy commotion." And, of course, once they got the churches going, that's the way the churches used to get everybody tied to Christianity, was to provide picnics and so forth for poor, lonely people. They still do the same things today. There were only the they offer all kinds of fun and games to get kids into church. Yeah. The endless drudgery and restless behavior of cooped-up children who were often prevented by bad weather from making the long trek to school. William Dean Howells describes how, as a youngster, he entertained himself by reading over and over again an old copy of the New York newspaper with which his father had wallpapered his cabin. Frontier life was most depressing on those who by nature were gregarious. The sense of abandonment was most keenly felt by homesteaders who came from small European villages where social gatherings and folk dances were a tradition, where life was hard but not lonesome. This sense of abandonment drove many settlers insane, especially the members of Swedish families. Proportionally, the largest number of immigrants who ended up in asylums were the Scandinavian origin, in other words, Aryans. I watched a movie not long ago where, due to conditions and so forth, a couple of women went crazy on the frontier, and this guy come along, and it was his job to take them in a wagon for several hundred miles to a place where they had a private asylum, and it's one hell of a movie. I forget the name of it, and all the problems they ran into on their way. In our time, it is a cliché to speak of the loneliness of the city, which is blamed for a variety of neuroses. But these are often the result of shallow relationships and the impersonality of urban culture. At least the city dweller is in touch with humanity on however tenuous a basis. The settlers on the frontier for months at a time did not even have even that little comfort. The parents who endured farm life were not necessarily rewarded by the golden promise of a comfortable old age surrounded and supported by their farming children. As a rule, the young hated the farm, its demoralizing hardships, its idiot monotony, its isolation, and as soon as they grew to independence, sometimes even before, thousands broke away from the land and settled in cities, large and small. Girls especially, sharing a mother's toil and witnessing to her premature disfigurement, were vehement in their prejudice. Frederick Law Olmsted was told by a young woman in 1870, quote, "If I were offered a deed of the best farm on the condition of going back to the country to live, I would not take it. I would rather face starvation in town," unquote. No matter what the conditions in workshop and factory, they seem more bearable than the slavery on the farm. The pay, modest as it was, exceeded what could be earned on the land, and even after long working hours, one's life was one's own. There was the excitement of new companionships and experiences, the satisfaction and the maturity that come with self-reliance, the diverse possibilities a city offers, in Olmsted's words, to nourish the juices of life. There was also the increased prospect of romance, and for the incorrigible dreamer, the chance of wealth and eternal happiness. The big cities offered endless opportunities for success and equally many for failure. Advice to the young immigrants warning them of the lures and pitfalls that awaited them was largely ignored. Young men who lacked the cunning and hardness to compete descended to menial work and sometimes to crime. Many girls who believed the city would solve their problems of boredom and isolation ended up as sweatshop seamstresses, many as prostitutes. Even before the Civil War and through the 1880s, and despite their many squalid features, the large cities were magnets that attracted great numbers of rural and small-town people. It was a great American exodus, thousands upon thousands of disillusioned, streaming cityward. Work. History offers a yardstick by which to measure the status of the American worker. Today he has some dignity and protection. Less than 100 years ago he was poor, debased, and unprotected. And we're going to move back towards that, it looks like to me. Industrialists of the period regarded labor as a commodity, a raw material like ore or lumber to be mined or of its vitality and flushed away. Profits were enormous against meager wages. Quote, "Never before have the rich been so rich and the poor been so poor," unquote. Actually, it's the same today with 2 or 3% of the country controlling almost all the wealth. An imbalance that helped 1% of the population by 1890 to own as much as the remaining 99% put together. And it hasn't changed that much. And is getting more that way all the time. Marshall Field's income was calculated to be $600 an hour, while his shop girls, at a salary of $3 to $5 a week, had to work over 3 years to earn that amount. Well, fast food, do the same thing today. Virtually unopposed by any organized front, by 1900, only 3.5% of the workforce was unionized. And that's what it's gotten back down to now. I think it's only 6% of the workforce are unionized, and they're going to rue the day they lost their unions. A New England shoe manufacturer sacked outright all his workers and replaced them with Chinese laborers he brought from the West Coast who were willing to work for $26 a month. Well, they don't even do that now. They ship the whole factory to China and Vietnam and so forth. To survive in the absence of social benefits, workers endured wretched conditions. The huge labor pool. See, now the wretched conditions are kept out of the country so the average American doesn't see what slave labor is like in these third world countries. pretty unique and pretty crafty on the part of the ruling class. And if labor unrest caused by occasional stir, industrialist Jay Gould was confident he had the solution for it. Quote, "I can hire one half of the working class to kill the other half," unquote. An honest guy. Rich, but at least he spoke the truth. It is apparent from this statement that Chauncey Depew never put in a 12-hour shift on the floor of a steel mill. My uncle worked on the steel mill floor all his life. I went in there a few times to see him, and I'm telling you, the heat and stench and noise, and I don't see how he ever could do it. Unless, of course, he enjoyed working in 117-degree heat in a smoky, conglomerate bedlam for a maximum of $1.25 a day. Now, my uncle made more money than that. He came out of the Army, went to work for Sibley Corporation in South Bend, Indiana. And I don't know whether the heat from the steel making affected him that way or not, but he became an alcoholic, and as soon as he'd get off work, he'd be at the bar. Or perhaps he was attracted by the laborers' hovels and their seven-day work week, conditions that were attended by constant danger that had destroyed the health of thousands by age 40 were inspired less by malice than by entrepreneurs' holy pledge to keep the cost of labor down. Yeah, at all costs. At any cost, which meant to keep the people down. Coal mines and iron and steel mills and the primordial industries were especially brutal on their manpower because of the constant pressure exerted on them by every other industry. In the mills, two shifts worked round the clock at a demonic pace, which faltered only at shift changeover. Shorter work periods, with their added pauses in production, were never considered. The economist J.G. Brooks quotes a mill foreman who admitted that the machines were deliberately set at the utmost of speed a human could endure. Quote, "It's a pity that men have to work like this, but there is no help for it. The machinery drives us at a gallop," unquote. Exposure to the infernal heat and poisonous gases endemic to their work shattered many steelworkers physical prematurely. Of these individuals, the unlucky ones were sacked, and the lucky ones were demoted with a comatant wage reduction from $1.25 to $1 or less a day. Aged workers were given jobs as sweepers or submenials, preferring to labor 12 hours a day for 75 cents than face a penniless retirement. See, that was before there was any Social Security, long before. Steel mills had no monopoly on serious health hazards. There was the sawdust of factories, the stone dust of quarries, the toxic emanations in chemical plants, and the coal dust in the mines. The miner, it was said, went down to work as to an open grave, not knowing when it might close on him. Usually the son followed the father, starting as a breaker boy at age 6 and often entering manhood stunted from the effects of early employment. That reminds me of the way they used to do the mines in Europe. I forget, I think it was up in England where they used to take brine and rub down on the arms of little kids to make them tough so they could crawl through these tunnels into the mine and mine the coal or whatever it happened to be. The headlong excesses of domestic industry were reflected in an accident rate that moved President Harrison in 1892 to observe, quote, "The American workmen are subjected to peril of life and limb as great as a soldier in time of war," unquote. In his classic book on poverty, Robert Hunter put the yearly total of killed and injured at 1 million, a higher number in proportion to the labor force than in any other nation. Aside from the steel mills, the railroad industry was the most lethal to its workers, killing in 1890 one railroader for every 306 employed, and injuring one for every 30 employed. out of a workforce of 749,301, this amounted to a yearly total of 2,451 deaths, which rose in 1900 to 2,675 killed and 41,142 injured. It should be noted that these casual lists cover only railroaders in the line of duty. Civilian casualties, train collisions, and level crossing accidents were another matter. The New York Evening Post concluded that the deaths caused by American railroads between June 1898 and 1900 were about equal to the British Army losses in the three-year Boer War. In the high-risk job category, the circus stuntman and test pilot today enjoyed greater life insurance than did the brakeman of yesterday, whose work called for precarious leaps between bucking freight cars at the command of the locomotive's whistle. And in icy weather, it often became a macabre dance of death, also subject to sudden death, albeit to a lesser degree, were the train couplers, whose omnipresent hazard was loss of hands and fingers in the primitive link and pin devices. It took an act of law in 1893 to force the railroads to replace these man-traps. Industry's cavalier attitude to safety, in other words, the ruling class attitude to safety, had a predictable effect on the lower echelon bosses. One railroad yard superintendent refused to roof a loading platform, even though in the cold his men had contracted rheumatism and asthma. His observation, quote, "Men are cheaper than shingles. There's a dozen waiting when one drops out." Whether a worker was mutilated by a buzzsaw, crushed by a beam, interred in a mine, or fell down a shaft, it was always his own bad luck, unquote. The courts, as a rule, sided with the employer. Well, usually they do now, too. In any event, few accident victims or their kin had the money to bring suit. Companies disclaimed responsibility, refused to install protective apparatus, and paid no compensation. Their only concession to human life was to pay for burying the dead. That's why they call me negative. But it's reality. This is the way it was. The guys down south, they said, "I'm a pessimist." No, I said, "I'm a realist." That's a lot different than a pessimist. There was one industry in the Gilded Age where sudden death and maiming were not occupational hazard, but where instead of this luxury, the alternatives of exhaustion or starvation were offered. This was the garment industry, and at its heart was the sweatshop, manned largely by newly arrived immigrants who had landed with high hopes and little cash. The sweatshops ran from factory-sized halls where men and women slaved under regimental supervision to the informality of a squalid room with an entire family engaged in piecework. The sweatshop operator, called sweater, shrewdly exploited the need of work and the shelter by offering the newcomers a package deal against an initial key payment of $5, he stuffed them into a slum and subcontracted work to them for a pittance. And this is exactly what goes on in the third world as the predatory capitalists move their factories over there. It's exactly what's going on now. And every once in a while, one of these factories starts on fire and burns up a whole bunch of people. Or like the Dow Chemical explosion over there in Darfur, India, where thousands of people, hundreds were killed and thousands were incapacitated. You see, these guys, they never change. These bastards never change. In New York's Lower East Side, the center of the industry, it was commonplace to find whole families working through the night merely to subsist. Now remember, before I go on, most of the people who promote and agree with this stuff are in the Republican Party. You got to admit the Democrat Party was once more of a party of the working man. Now, you know, it's got a lot of problems with the Democrat Party now, and they surely now have combined with the predatory capitalists and the Republicans to do about the same thing. But at one time, the Democrat Party was the champion of the working people, and most of the safety things that were brought online for the workers was promoted and pushed by the Democrats. Plus, the Democrat Party used to being the champion of the white race, too. What happened to the Democrat Party? With rents $8 to $12 a month and living costs per individual a minimum of $5 a month, a garment worker could not support a family solely on his own pay. Consequently, his wife and children were sucked into the grim cycle of working and sleeping. At the risk of his health, a man would make $9 to $10 a week for pressing and delivering new garments to the wholesaler. A woman made $7 for the punishing job of seaming 3 dozen shirts. The standard wage for a girl was $3 to $5, which, according to the head of the Women's Protective Union, Mrs. M.W. Ferrer, yielded her no more than a loaf of bread, a cup of tea, and a bed in a tenement attic. When asked how the sweatshop girls could live, she said, quote, "They can't." Bread and tea formed the staple diet of the sweater's victims, to whom even the preparation of beans was a costly and worrisome task. And the pressure to produce increased as families grew. The humanitarian Robert Spargo recalls an interview with a mother of four whose husband's greatest efforts brought home no more than $6 a week. Quote, "It's awful," she said. "I must work, else we get nothing to eat and turned into the streets. Besides, often we go to our beds as we left them, cooking. Oh, I cook nothing, for I haven't the time to cook." When's the last time you heard a Republican or any of these fat cats, these political parties, talking about this kind of stuff? Unless they had some kind of a personal angle to build them more power. While Cosmopolitan magazine observed that sewing in a sweatshop was the most grinding oppression that can be practiced on a woman, it was not the most dangerous occupation. There were the soap packing plants, for instance, where girls were exposed to caustic soda that turned their nails yellow and ate away at their fingers. There were the flour making workshops where arsenic, liberally applied to produce vivid colors, wrecked the appearance and health of thousands of girls with sores, swelling of the limbs, nausea, and often complete debility. Similar things are going on right now. They've just shipped them out of the country. The cities of the Gilded Age had an excess of these plants, and 12 hours a day in their toxic atmosphere left their mark on workers for life. But nothing compared with the hazards and indignities of the tobacco in-home factories. Here, for a meager income, women and children were forced to endure the most sickening exhalations as they stripped the leaves. Harper's Magazine described the effects of endless hours of this work. Quote, "Their eyes are dead, a stupor overcomes them, their nerves are unsettled, and their lungs diseased in almost every case," unquote. So it wasn't just the people smoking the tobacco, it was the people putting the tobacco together to be smoked. If tobacco, you know, and let me remind you of something. The Third Reich under Uncle Adolf had made an exhaustive scientific study and found tobacco to cause cancer, and they had all the research there is. And to show you what rats the people were that were making all the money on cigarettes and chewing tobacco and so forth, at the end of the war, the British swept into this where these papers were stored and took all that research and took it to the Tower of London and hid it and would not expose it. So that shows you what the ruling class, again and again, think of the people in general. If tobacco, the only good thing about it is a lot of those rich guys smoked too much and died too. If tobacco, of course, Uncle Adolf would not allow smoking in his presence. So for whatever you want to say about Uncle Adolf, He did have some good points. If tobacco stripping was the nadir of sweatshop employment, then the sewing room of A.T. Stewart, New York's greatest retailer of the 1870s, was perhaps its zenith. Here was to be found a thin layer of civility, air that was relatively clean, but Stewart ran his 2,000 workers with an iron hand, assessing fines against latecomers and those who misdirected bundles. Hours were from 7:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. at night, and sewing girls received $3 a week, a notoriously low salary even then. Bathroom facilities were inadequate, perhaps deliberately so, in order to keep the needles humming, and this proved a menace to the health of the young girls who endured discomfort when men around rather... Whoop, wait a minute. When men were around rather than run the gauntlet in humiliation, although Stewart was criticized for regarding his workers as mere cogs in the machinery of his establishment, he was more widely acclaimed as a man of impeccable honesty, whose sewing room was a model of decent employment practices, and that is the media propaganda that the ruling class always puts out. You think I'm beginning to sound like a communist? I'm not, but I'm telling you, I don't want any part of the ruling class. Like the Jew said, eat the rich. Not only did they take them, as a southern manager said in reference to children working in his factory, but running machines late at night, they were sometimes kept awake by the vigilant superintendent with the cold water dashed onto their faces. Late meant 2 o'clock in the morning in upstate New York, where the mere babies were found employed in a cannery in their utter weariness after work. These children often forgot their hunger and fell asleep with food in their mouths. Child labor was not just a sporadic manifestation of Victorian cold-bloodedness. It was a widespread practice encouraged by industry and the rich, agreed to by parents and generally ignored by the government. For employees, the tiny workers were a bargain at $1.50. I guess that's a day, or maybe it's a week, I don't know, to $2.50 a week. And besides, they claimed that the factory work was good for the little devils. The Puritan work ethic prevailed against the sloth of children, their idleness by which they are corrupted. Now, you wonder what would keep people from turning to crime? I guess religion or something. I mean, why would you not turn to a life of crime if you could get yourself out of this crap? Something to think about. Well, tens of thousands of people did go to a life of crime. Less culpable, perhaps, were the poor parents who were seduced into giving their assent at the prospect of reducing their struggle even by so small a margin. And many children appeased their parents' conscience by fancying factory work over school, which by law they had to attend 14 weeks a year to become eligible for work. Sometimes child laborers and their parents would lie about their age to obtain employment. In fact, children in Syracuse, New York, in 1904 were heard to complain, quote, "The factories will not take you unless you are 8 years old," unquote. Whatever the circumstances, the little workers got no special favors. Their hours were as long as their conditions, as grim as those of an adult. Some textile mill boys were so small they had to be raised on boxes to service the twirling spindles, their hands in constant danger of being caught. Young mine workers exposed to poisonous dust and injury earned 25 cents for a 12 to 14 hour day. They should make this forced reading in all the schools, you know. There were opponents of child labor, among them charitable institutions, but they proved powerless against the super rich. A law had been passed as early as 1842 by Massachusetts, always a leader in humanitarian causes, that confined the workday of children under age 12 to 10 hours. But this state and others with similar statutes lacked the means to enforce them. You see, The rich controlled the politics. What's new? With an estimated 6% of its child population engaged in factory work in the 1880s, New York State had only 2 industrial inspectors. Under such sparse surveillance, the importing of child labor went on freely. The children were transported from Tennessee, where a prohibitive law was in force, to South Carolina, where none existed. Little children from 7 to 14 years of age were shipped like cattle or hogs. An 1870 census put the total of child workers at 700,000, but this did not include the thousands who worked city streets as vendors, messengers, and shoeshine boys. Child labor actually grew threefold in the South in the decade from 1890, increasing the national figure in 1900 to 1,752,887. One third of all mill employees were children. They also worked in tobacco fields, canneries, and mines, and meat packing, hosiery, silk, wool, hemp, and jute mills. Finally, in 1904, the National Child Labor Committee was formed and began its vigorous campaign to protect the coming generations. Well, the next time we get together, we're going to go into the standard of living. Steady work, nothing steady, but want and misery. So that's it for today, boys and girls. I hope I haven't destroyed your whole holiday. Well, if I got into the con job of the Revolutionary War like I was going to, you'd even be more pissed off. But I got to go back in that labyrinth of my library and find that book, which I suppose I will have one section where I try to keep all the books that I'm always referring to out from the number of 100, 200, 300, 400 books there. I pick certain ones that I refer to a lot. Anyhow, we're going to have to change things because it's becoming too frustrated to do research. And I'll go crazy down here in the cave, man. Let's see, tomorrow, Saturday, maybe I'll do something tomorrow. Thanks for getting your donations for the show in. There's several came in today. I appreciate that so we can keep things moving here. Yeah, 14-5.
Lace up boots, faded jeans, a homemade sandwich, a half a jug of tea. Average Joe, average pay, same old end, the same old day. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer, kind of glue that sticks this world together, and the steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man. Making a living, life keeps taking, he keeps giving. Behind the scene, below the grade, I hardly noticed, but part of everything. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer, kind of glue that sticks this world together, hands of steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man. His life then fades away. Another young man takes his place. Average Joe, average pay, the same old end, the same old day. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer, kind of glue that sticks this world together, hands of steel and cradle of the promised land. This world together. bless the working man.